Thank you, Bob. 50-mile-an-hour winds.
Yeah, I felt it, too.
Really?
I walked from the L at Block 37, that area off the blue line.
Yeah.
So I walked State Street, and I had to turn backwards for part of it.
I was on Metro yesterday, and then I walked down to the station, to the Tribune Tower, and I'm just always reminded on a windy day how the tall buildings, the canyons of steel, exaggerate the wind. You know, it kind of funnels it down.
Oh, yeah.
So I think a 20-mile-an-hour wind is a 30-mile-an-hour wind. And I don't know what it's like downtown right now, but 50-plus, I'll bet you, in some of those corridors, you know.
It was on that particular corridor earlier. Yeah.
And it's windy, isn't it?
It's windy.
By the way, I love what they're doing along the river. I hadn't noticed in a long time, but you know where they've got that sort of cement facade and the steps?
Yeah.
They're now planting trees within that sort of, you know, scaffolding of steps that go from the river up to Upper Wacker Drive there.
That's cool.
And so they've got this real neat walkway, and then, you know, the push carts or restaurants can be built in there. But coming right out of the cement, they've just cut holes, just room enough to drop a ball of a tree in there. And so you've got trees growing out of these concrete steps. It's really cool. I appreciate the effort, money, and imagination that goes into something like that. You could blow it off. They didn't have to do any of that. But it looks good. It looks good.
It does look good. And I'm waiting for the river to be in the condition that we can go swimming in it. Wouldn't that be cool?
You mean like in 1,000 years?
Have you been to Zurich, Switzerland?
Not lately, no.
I've been there, actually. I've been there twice. And so the river that goes through the town there is a little like the Chicago River, although it's mostly alpine snowmelt. And they have ladders, like swimming ladders.
Really?
Right along in certain places.
Imagine a major city where they invite you to swim in that river.
Go swim in. But Zurich's mostly a financial center. There's not a lot of heavy industry, I don't think.
No.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, they have ladders, though, over at the lake.
That they do.
You know, and I've actually climbed down or jumped in there, and I tell my friends in the suburbs about it, and they gasp.
It's, you know, a good friend of mine's a limnologist.
They think I'm going to hit like a garbage can or a tire when I get into the water. What is a limnologist?
I didn't know this until he told me. It's a scientist who studies lakes. And so he's an expert on the Great Lakes. And he said it's some of the cleanest water in the world once you get about 50 feet out.
It looks good to me.
Yeah.
And even if when you are swimming along at Oak Street or North Street or the one over here by Navy Pier, I forget which one that's called. That's the one I swim in. Every now and then you'll come across a baggie, you know, or something that...
That'll happen in Yellowstone National Park.
It could
Park.
Happen anywhere. By the way, one last note about this. I forget why I was reading about this. Oh, I know. The city of Minneapolis is debating whether or not to ban plastic bags. Chicago's gone through this song and dance, so they've just now passed an ordinance. They're not going to have plastic bags. Say what you want about that. One of the statistics that came out in the debate is this. There is now more plastic and man-made garbage in the world's oceans than there are fish. The total mass of swimming life in the sea is less than the mass of garbage we now have in there.
Well, the Chicago ban, though, if you go to a store, that certain stores say it's a large chain drugstore, they'll still give you a bag. It's just a, quote, reusable bag.
Yeah.
Which people don't then reuse.
Well,
so it's kind of...
Well, Kristen was showing me hers the other day from Walgreens, and she goes, look, this bag is thicker than the one we used to have. I'm sure there's some science to it that she and I don't appreciate, but it didn't look like a trade-up to me. I don't know how you improved your condition with that thing.
Well, people don't tend to keep the bags, even though they're supposed to be. Reusable bags are the ones that have, like, nice nylon.
Sure.
You got to bring your own. So, yeah, it was kind of a weird compromise that I don't think anyone ends off any better.
I want to tell you one weird place where my head was this week. I've had in my mind the Patty Duke theme song. Patty Duke died early this week. And I've been walking around singing it because when she died, everybody does the quick obit and then they play a few bars of the song. And it dawned on me once again that there was an era when a TV sitcom theme song, maybe drama too, but there were plenty of TV shows that seemed to put some effort into their theme songs. Here's hers.
Meet Kathy, who lived most everywhere. From Zanzibar to Berkeley Square, but Patty's only seen the sights a girl can see from Brooklyn Heights. What a crazy pair! But they're cousins, identical cousins all the way. One pair of matching bookends, different as night and day. Where Kathy adores a minuet,
the ballet, Roos and Crepe Suzette.
Our Patty loves her rock and roll, the hot dog makes her lose control. And what a wild duet. Still left cousins, identical cousins, than you'll find. They laugh alike, they walk alike, at times they even talk alike. You can lose your mind when cousins.
For the commercials at the end. Watch this. Stand by.
The Patty Duke Show.
Yeah.
Is brought to you by Nabisco, makers of quality cookies,
yeah,
crackers, cereals, yeah, and so many other good things to eat.
I'm glad to hear
Nabisco.
That. Thank you. That's how a TV show used to start. If you got lucky, you got the 60-second extended dance version like that.
Same guy who wrote the Christmas song.
No kidding.
Mel Torme and Robert Wells wrote the Christmas song together. That I knew. I didn't know. I just looked it up. Robert Wells wrote the Patty Duke theme song.
So then I looked up. I did the wiki on Patty Duke. And it bears mention, even today. Born Anna Marie Duke in Elmhurst, New York. The youngest of three children. Her mother was a cashier. Her dad was a cab driver. Their father was an alcoholic. Their mother suffered from clinical depression. She was prone to violence. And so when Patty was 8 years old, her care was turned over to talent managers, John and Ethel Ross. They had been promoting her brother. They were looking for a girl to add to their stable of child actors. And so the Rosses took over the ownership, if you will, the management, the raising of Patty Duke. Their style was described as unscrupulous and exploitative. They consistently billed Duke as being 2 years younger than she actually was so that they would get more mileage out of the child star. They padded her resume with false credits. They gave her alcohol and drugs when she was young to tide her over at the age of 13. And they took unreasonable fees from her. They made sexual advances to her. Some say, Patty says, she was assaulted by them. And when Patty Duke turned 18 years old, having earned a lot of money, she was able to emancipate herself as an adult and found that they had squandered every dime she had ever earned. In 1959, at the age of 12, she appeared on the $64,000 question. And she won $32,000 in 1964. Her category of expertise was spelling. 3 years later, 1962, it was revealed that the game show had been rigged, and she was called to testify before a panel of the United States Senate. They said that she had been coached. And in fact, she had. They were cheating. And they told her what to say to that Senate panel. More about that in just a minute. Duke's first major starring role was playing Helen Keller. Anne Bancroft was Annie Sullivan in the Broadway play The Miracle Worker that ran from 59 to 61. During the run, Duke's name was elevated to above the play's name on the marquee, believed to be the first time such a young star had received such notation. The play was subsequently made into a 62 film. She won the Best Supporting Actress Award at 16, the youngest person ever to have received an Academy Award in a competitive category. Her own series was The Patty Duke Show, with Sidney Sheldon creating it, especially for her, began in 1963. At that time, it was not known that Patty Duke herself suffered from bipolar disorder. And Sheldon, he didn't know that, and it didn't have that name then. But he noticed that she had two very distinct personalities. And he said, well, let's do a show where you play two characters because you kind of are two characters. And so they said, you'll be identical cousins, whatever that is, with contrasting personalities. Duke portrayed the main characters, Patty Lane, the fun-loving American teenager who sometimes got into mild trouble at school and home, now Patty, and her prim and proper identical cousin from Scotland, Kathy Lane. After the cancellation of the Patty Duke Show, her adult acting career began. She played Neely O'Hara in Valley of the Dolls. The film was a box office success, but audiences and critics had a difficult time accepting that the all-American teenage girl they knew as Patty Duke would be an alcoholic and drug-addicted singing star that she was portraying in the show, none of them knowing that actually that adult portrayal was closer to her truth. Well, the film has since become a camp classic, in part to her over-the-top acting. At the time, it almost ruined her career. She gradually reduced her work schedule in the 2000s, but took occasional TV roles. You should see her on Hawaii 5-0 or in an episode of Glee. She returned to the stage a couple of times. She directed performances of The Miracle Worker. In 1987, in her autobiography, she said that she'd been diagnosed with manic depression, now called bipolar disorder, in 1982. She's one of the first public figures to talk about mental health and say, "It's me." She received all sorts of accommodations and honorary degrees. She lobbied before Congress on that. And with lithium and with counseling and other medication and treatment, she brought her dual personality sort of into control. On December 14th, 2007, she was awarded an honorary doctorate in humane letters from the University of North Florida. She was married four times and had three children. And she died this week at the age of 69. You also find, when you just do a tiny bit of clicking around about Patty Duke, this story from one of the other contestants who was also coached to cheat on the $64,000 question. And he said this: "Patty told me this at lunch one afternoon, and I was absolutely appalled, because when Patty was on the $64,000 question doing spelling, they coached her. And it was from Patty. I know who it was. From Patty, but I will let Patty mention the name if she ever wants to. But they coached her on the answers. That's when she was about 12. 3 years later, she's 15, and she's summoned down to the United States Senate to testify in their investigation. And she was coached again on how to lie to the Senate about cheating on the $64,000 question. She went down there and she testified, and she lied until she was ready to step down, when one of the senators looked at her and said to this 15-year-old girl, 'Now, Patty, is everything you've told us here today the truth?' At which point, she broke down and started to cry. And she said, 'No.' And he said, 'Then get back up here and tell us what happened.' And they put her on the stand again. And she told the whole story. That's what we used to do to those TV shows. It's amazing, the Patty Duke story. Here on WGN, all that from, which was in my mind the last couple of days, is a pretty good jazzy theme song. It's 120, an excerpt from Thomas Jefferson. This is fun. We do a podcast each week, and actually two. One's called The Mincing Rascals, and we excerpt that here on my Saturday show. But each week, almost every Friday, talk with Thomas Jefferson. And he had a couple of really interesting things to say to us this week, which are especially relevant today. Part one of that in a minute here on WGN. Don't forget, at 4 o'clock this afternoon here on WGN Radio, our coverage of the Final Four. Yeah, we have the Final Four. Pregame coverage at 4, game one at 5, the second game after that, all on WGN Radio. The first game will feature a couple of teams, and then after that a couple of other teams will play. Neither of them will be my Butler Bulldogs.
Are they in your brackets at all? Any bracketing?
Well, let's see. I've got Michigan State, Xavier, Oklahoma. I have. Is Oklahoma still in it by any chance? I don't know. I've lost all the will to even care about those things.
Yes, Oklahoma and Villanova.
Happy for them. So here is the deal. I sat down with Thomas Jefferson yesterday, and there are two things I want to play for you. One of the segments will come in the next hour when he talked about maybe a smarter, better way to elect a president. Imagine that. But in this segment, he talked a little bit about Alexander Hamilton, about the $10 bill, about that Broadway musical. We started out with him just mentioning in an offhand way what it was like when he first came back from France and a letter was waiting for him.
I was down in Norfolk, Virginia, where actually I returned to the United States from France in 1789 with my two daughters, Martha and Maria. And when we arrived at the port, there was a letter waiting from me from the new president of the United States, George Washington, telling me that he had nominated me to be his Secretary of State, and the Senate had confirmed the nomination. And so without ever asking me, he made me the first Secretary of State.
Well, you could always say, "Hey, I didn't vote for you."
It is impossible, really, to say no to George Washington. We hauled him out of retirement to preside over the Constitutional Convention. He did not wish to do that. And then, of course, we made him the first president of the United States, and he did not wish that either. When he had resigned his commission after the war, one of the most extraordinary events in human history, that the successful commander of a revolution resigned his commission and returned to his private life. When he did that, he expected never again to be in the public arena. So when we drafted him, first for the Constitutional Convention and then for the first presidency, he felt that his historical reputation might suffer and that people might think of him as a man of ambition because he had not been able to enforce his desire for a quiet rural retirement.
It's kind of the opposite these days. What's the point of being a revolutionary if you then don't get to govern the people and enjoy the spoils, you know?
We knew some things that I think you've all forgotten. We had been reading our Plutarch. Plutarch was a Greek writing about the history of leadership in the Greek and Roman world, and he made parallel lives between people like Cicero and Solon and Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar. And one of his short biographies was about a man named Cincinnatus who saved Rome on the battlefield, but then immediately went back to his small farm and took up his plow and retired to private life. And we all had studied these worthies, these great heroes of the ancient world, and we tried to shape our own leadership styles in the shadow of those great men who existed in the democracy of Athens or the Republic of ancient Rome. So we had a different attitude towards power, I think, than the ambitious political figures of your time.
Well, speaking, though, of men of ambition, I got bad news for you on the Hamilton front.
How's that?
Well, he's on our $10 bill. And the Treasury said that they were going to take him off the $10 bill and that we would put somebody else on there. And there's been sort of this national debate about who that person should be. But because of the success of the Broadway hit Hamilton, have you seen that show yet, Thomas Jefferson?
I have not, but I have heard about it.
It's a really good show, singing and dancing and real good storytelling. It makes you want to be an American. It makes you want to be in the game, in the room, as they say. Anyway, it's a hit, and people love Hamilton so much now that they're saying maybe we should take Jackson off the 20 or not, but we might just go ahead and keep Hamilton on the 10. The timing is good to keep him there now.
I hope you're not spending much of your national time on questions of this triviality. I'm not in favor of paper currency in the first place, but if anyone belongs on currency, it's Colonel Hamilton. He's the father of the American economic system. He's the creator of the national debt. He's the father of centralized federal banking in the United States. There's one and only one person who must be on one of your coins, and that is Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, but you say that to spite him. We do it to honor these people. I mean, you're on our currency, too, you know.
I'm the $2 bill and the nickel. I suppose I should see that as humiliating.
Just saying. That's our conversation with Thomas Jefferson. You can find it at WGNplus.com. You can subscribe to it on the iTunes store as well. It's a 129. Let's catch you up on WGN Radio News in a minute, and then afterwards, a conversation with a guy from BlinkHealth.com, where it's amazing how inexpensively you can buy prescription drugs these days. That's coming up on GN. All right, thank you, Bob. Jeffrey Chaykin is on a phone line. He is the co-founder of Blink Health and BlinkHealth.com. It's an app. It's a website where you're able to buy the prescription drugs that maybe you are buying now. Maybe your doctor's prescribing them. You do or don't have insurance. But there's a website and an app you go to, and you're able to get the very same things at a fraction of the cost. If you can't, don't use the site. But it's pretty interesting. You may have seen this company, this site, this app featured on the CBS Morning News this week. And when I saw it, I thought, that's pretty amazing. I still don't know how they do that. So we called Jeffrey Chaykin, who's the co-founder of BlinkHealth.com. Jeffrey, this is John Williams, and you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, John.
Congratulations. How's it going?
It's, we launched about 8 weeks ago on the NBC Nightly News and then the Today Show. And then, as you mentioned, we were on CBS this morning last week. And it's pretty much been a rocket ship since we launched. It seems that, you know, most Americans are overpaying for their medications. And we've really, you know, found a solution that Americans are finding incredibly helpful.
How does it work?
The way that it works is a patient goes to the website or the app. they blinkhealth.com. They search for the medication that they're interested in. So they'll just type in the name and they'll actually see the price right then and there. If you like the price because it's lower than your copay, most of our patients have insurance. If you don't have insurance, it's going to be the lowest price you'll be able to find. You hit the pay button, you enter your payment information, and you receive a Blink digital pharmacy card, which you're able to present to a pharmacist. And that looks exactly like a insurance card to the pharmacist. And so because you prepaid, you pay nothing at the pharmacy. So that's pretty much how it works. It's available at every pharmacy in the country.
Walgreens?
It's available at Walgreens, CVS, all of the independent pharmacies,
Costco.
Over 60,000 pharmacies, Costco, pretty much everyone. And if they're not on the network, which they should be, they can give us a call and we'll make sure to get them right on. But pretty much every pharmacy in the country is part of the Blink network.
So I pay the app or website, and then I go to pick it up at the drugstore.
That's correct.
And when I do that, am I using my insurance or am I doing this in lieu of my prescription insurance?
So what you do, you actually do this in lieu of your prescription insurance. So when you use Blink, you're working outside of insurance. And what most Americans don't realize or what they think is because they're paying, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars a month for their premiums on insurance, that they're getting the best prices on their prescription medications. But in most cases, that's actually not the case. The insurance company is actually profiting off of the drug benefit, and we cut out the insurance company. And that's part of the way that we're able to offer much lower prices to Americans.
But I didn't cut out the insurance company. You're telling me that even though I'm paying a premium for my insurance coverage, my employer's paying some, I'm paying a premium as well, and I have some prescription coverage. I think mine is pretty good, actually. I'll go to the drugstore, and sometimes I'll ask, what did this thing cost? And they'll say it was $172. I say, well, I only paid $23, and I really appreciate that. But that's the value of my insurance. You're telling me that even though I'm doing that, if I don't use that insurance and my copay is only $23, forget that I'm paying that premium. Just pretend I'm not, though I am. I'll go ahead and use your app, and you'll be able to beat my copay price?
That's correct. So the way that Blink works is it's really about power and numbers. So we put deals in place, and we use technology to make a huge group of Americans. So we look to the pharmacies like we're 25 million people, and that gives us a lot of negotiating power. So when you're part of the Blink Health Group, which you become a member of for free when you join the when you make a purchase, you are part of a much larger group than you're likely part of as part of your employer, and so you're able to access lower prices. Now the price may not always be lower for Blink with Blink than it would be with your insurance. So but the unique thing about Blink is it's really the only place in this industry where you get to know the price of the medication before you get to the pharmacy. So what we're encouraging everyone to do is just always check the Blink price, and if it's lower, you should use it. And if it's not lower, then obviously, you know, we wouldn't want you to use it. And if you made a purchase, they're fully refundable. So we don't want to make any money unless we're saving you money.
Well, how are you making money, though? Because you don't charge me to be a Blink Health member, right?
That's correct.
Well, where's the money for you?
So the way that we make money is actually on a per transaction basis. We collect a small transaction fee. And another thing that's important about Blink Health is that it's one price. When you go to our website and you search for a particular medication, whether, you know, 50% of our medications are under $10. So, you know, Lipitor is $9.94, Norvasc is $4.96.
Wait a minute, stop. Lipitor is how much?
$9.94.
People pay $150 for Lipitor. With insurance, they'll pay $27 for Lipitor.
That's correct. So half of our medications are under $10. So, you know, people with the best platinum insurance, you know, typically will pay $10 copays on their generics, and half of our medications are under $10. Norvasc, which is a blood pressure medication that tens of millions of Americans are on, is only $4.96. And we have actually $5 off your first purchase. So in that case, your Norvasc would be free.
Okay, let me Prilosec, yeah. Just I want to hit you with some names. Do Prilosec.
Prilosec is $6.95 on our website. Simvastatin, Zocor, is $4.92, Propecia, which, as you saw the segment on CBS Nightly News, is a medication that men take for hair loss, which is usually not covered by insurance. So I was personally actually paying $120 at my local pharmacy in New York City, and with Blink, it's $19.97. So I'm actually personally saving about $1,200
wow.
a year.
All right, hold on.
Just on that particular medication.
All right, I'll ask. How about the Viagra?
So Viagra is a branded medication, and you'll find that our price on Viagra is expensive because we can't negotiate a lot with them. But it's about $40 a pill. But there was a piece that was in the New York Post that was published about us, where you can get the same active ingredient as in Viagra in the 20 milligram dosage versus the 25 milligram dosage. And that's 70 cents with Blink Health. So I'd encourage everyone to look up that New York Post article that talks about how you can get exactly the same medication as Viagra, it's just in a lower dosage on Blink Health, for 70 cents instead of $40 a pill. So it's that, you know, that's a way that we're able to provide tremendous savings on Viagra.
You know, one of the,
$40, as my partner and CFO said, you know, $40 is an expensive night out, but 70 cents is a lot more reasonable for all the
but
men.
You know,
out
the,
there.
You know one of the takeaways, I guess, from all of this is how overpriced, I guess, prescription medicine is. Because I thought that at least if I bit the bullet and had coverage insurance, that the copay makes it, you know, a reasonable exchange. But you're saying that if you didn't have that, you could still get it at a lower price for half of the medication you're taking. And I'm thinking, well, I don't think we're going to bankrupt these pharmaceutical companies. So, boy, somebody is overpaying them.
Yeah, you know, the pharmacy is just a very strange place in retail, and there's been no transparency. So I often, you know, encourage people to think about, is there any other place that you know of, John, where you don't know the price of an item until you get to the register? In retail, I mean, it sort of doesn't really exist anywhere else.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking. No.
Or where three people will go to the register with exactly the same item, and they'll pay three drastically different prices
well,
at the same store.
And I think one of the reasons we don't is because we're ignorant, we're lazy, or because we think it doesn't matter. I've got insurance. It's going to be more than I want to pay, but I have to do this. The doctor prescribed this.
A prescription from your doctor.
Yeah.
You're,
so
you're there. You've got this prescription. Your doctor's told you need it, and you kind of feel like you don't have a choice. And
but I saw this statistic that 1/3 of all prescriptions written are never picked up because people can't afford or are afraid of the price.
Yeah, there's sticker shock. So basically what happens is a third of prescriptions are just left at the pharmacy counter because when someone sees the price, they're
really
shocked at it. And we've all actually seen this probably when we've been in the pharmacy. You know, we've seen someone who's picking up several medications and the pharmacist will say to them, you know, this is going to be $100. Is that okay? And they're like, no.
And then
okay.
They just walk away. They leave it there.
And then they just walk away. And so it's a real tragedy. And 50% of medications just aren't taken. So people will take them home, but they'll pill split or they'll skip a day or, you know, they'll take their medication every other day because it's a huge portion of people's weekly budgets. So it's just there's a tremendous human cost to this high cost of prescription medications that hasn't been told. And you know, we want to bring awareness to that and let people know that we're out there trying to help them.
The website is blinkhealth.com. He's been calling it Blink. I have too, but to be clear, it's blinkhealth.com.
Blink
when you download the app, it's Blink Health that you'll want to search for on your phone. And to be fair, also, some of the medications that my colleagues and I have searched for came up less expensive. Some of them came up the same. Some of them came up more expensive. But that's sort of irrelevant, isn't it? Because you're not obligated. If you find a better price than your copay, then use it. And if you don't, right?
That's exactly right. I couldn't have described it better myself.
Hmm. Fascinating. Well, good for you. Nicely done, Jeffrey. Maybe we'll talk again, answer more questions for people. But that's a good start. I appreciate your time this afternoon.
Anytime. Thanks very much, John.
Interesting. Jeffrey Chaykin. Okay, so there's that. How about that? Blink Health. blinkhealth.com. It's $149 on WGN. If you go to my Facebook page, I'm King John on Facebook. I posted this, and I'm pretty much blowing up the internets today. 36,000 views and now over 100 shares, and I think I know why people are sharing it, but let me read it first. It's just a second, and then if you want to see it, share it or comment, and hundreds of you are. Just like me on Facebook. I'm King John there. I wrote yesterday, it's rare to see the moment when someone actually comes to a decision point. 50 seconds in on the clip provided, you will see Donald Trump, apparently never having thought seriously about reproductive rights, deciding this is his eureka moment. You can actually watch in the clip and see his eyes dart down and to the right as he conjures up an opinion that, yes, he's against abortion, and yes, where it is illegal, women should be punished for it. Facing the white tornado of questions, that's Chris Matthews. He wasn't clear on what the punishment should be. He fumbled when asked if the fathers of these unborn children should be punished too. And then later, he had another moment of clarity, saying in a campaign statement that the abortion provider should be punished, but not the women. The woman is a victim, he said. Stay tuned for more on this developing gray matter. There have been similar moments when you realize, holy cow, he not only doesn't have an opinion on Topic X, but he's never even thought about it. At the GOP debate in Miami, Trump said that if he were president and had to deal with Cuba, that he would, quote, make a deal. It would be great, but it's got to be a great deal for the United States, not a bad deal for the United States. And the crowd actually chuckled. Cuba isn't a pressing issue for most Americans, but it was fun to watch words coming out of his mouth even as he was thinking them for the first time. Same the other night at the GOP town hall meeting in Milwaukee, Trump talked about what a disaster NATO is. We need a new organization, he said, and maybe we do. But you could tell as he spoke that he hadn't thought this one through. Afterward, analyst David Gregory was amazed at how short and wrong Trump's reach on this topic was. The emperor has no clothes. We've all been waiting for that cataclysmic moment where he fails so spectacularly that his candidacy then crumbles, but it seems now that's just not going to happen. Possibly his campaign will die from a million self-inflicted cuts. A leader should do more than just harness anger. A leader should know where he's going. And Donald Trump time and again demonstrates that he does not. Someone should start a hashtag, stuff Donald doesn't know. President Obama spoke about that today. I guess that's his bias, but I don't think he's alone on that. You can comment on that on my Facebook page. I'm King John there. It's 156. Thank you, Bob. John Williams here. By the way, in our Vibe Score segment in the next half hour, we'll take sort of the pressure, the blood pressure, the pulse, if you will, of various topics that are in the news. That's what we do in Vibe Score. It's kind of a fast whip around of everything from TV to politics to what's going on in Chicago. You'll get it when you hear it. That's in the next half hour. But one of the things we asked you about is, what do you make of the tactic of, say, closing streets for a march or a rally to protest the fact that you're not happy with the funding for the schools and you don't like your contract? The scores on Vibe Score for that strategy are low. Now, we'll get to that in just a couple of minutes, but on the education front for a minute. Let's talk about this story in the Chicago Tribune. You can see it online and in tomorrow's paper. High schoolers, parents are wary of Illinois colleges as budget crisis hits the schools. On a phone line is the author of that piece. This is Dawn Rhodes. Hi, Dawn. It's John Williams. You're on GN. How are you? I don't think I did that right, did I? There you are. Hi, Dawn. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks so much for having me.
What was the inspiration for this story? I mean, to walk me through the idea process of even writing this one.
Well, our higher education reporter, Jody Cohen, was the one who kind of came up with the idea. And she just knew that this is a recruiting season. This is a really important time for colleges right now. As students are making their final decisions about where to enroll. So we figured that all the reporting that not only us, but, you know, other outlets have been doing about the state of higher education and the state of public schools and how they're struggling to get by without any state financing, we realized that that must be having some kind of an impact on just the perception of whether or not this is a good idea for high schoolers and parents, you know, to enroll in a state school. So that's kind of where it came from. So we just sought out high school seniors and parents to find out if indeed this was really undermining their confidence in state schools right now. And, you know, this is the result. It certainly seems like it is. It's definitely having an impact.
Yeah. Talk about that. What did you find?
Well, we did find that we did find a lot of parents who, even if they hadn't necessarily decided they didn't want to send their kid to a state school, they were second guessing it. Not necessarily in terms of enrolling next year or the year after that, but they were really concerned about whether or not schools would be in good financial shape 4 years from now, and that whether or not their kids would be able to finish and get their degrees, and whether there would be some kind of a problem where they would have to transfer, and where would their credits go, and whether or not whether or not programs would, you know, specific programs would shut down. Things like that. So, but a lot of parents did say, you know, we're just not willing to take that risk. This is tens of thousands of dollars. It's a major investment for our child and for our family. And we don't want to have this anxiety hanging over their head about whether or not they're going to be able to get their degree.
That's a pretty apocalyptic outlook, isn't it, though? I mean, it's amazing too, because I read the story and you found plenty of kids and parents who either have anxiety about the issue, mm-hmm. or, in fact, making decisions. A kid who's got a ride to the U of I. I mean, that's the golden ticket.
And yes, it absolutely is.
He's going to go to Iowa or someplace else, because I'm thinking, who gives up a scholarship to the University of Illinois?
Right. I mean, and that's shocking that there are kids who are getting, you know, pretty decent scholarship offers, and that in any other year, they would scoop that up in a heartbeat. But they're that concerned in terms of scholarships. What we heard a lot of parents say is that they were just worried about whether or not that scholarship money somehow would stop in the next couple of years. If things got really tight and, certain schools just didn't have enough money to honor those scholarships, that's what they were really concerned about.
Well, you're answering my next question there, because I thought, look, the U of I in Northern Illinois, Northeastern, mm-hmm. you cite in a couple of instances. I think you had a kid that was thinking about or going to Chicago State, et cetera. Those some of those schools' future is a little more dubious than others. But the point is, those buildings and those schools are going to be there, and someone's going to teach there. They're not just going to shutter these things. But what you could probably do to the kid is say, yeah, but that aid that we promised you, since the state funding has mm-hmm. not come through, or it's not mm-hmm. there at all, or it's diminished, you're not. So there you are, enrolled in a school, kind of committed, right? Nobody wants to transfer if they can avoid it. But now you're having to pay more of the freight. I guess those pledges from the schools aren't guaranteed, eh?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily not guaranteed, but just nobody really knows, you know, how bad is this going to get? And we've already seen it gone much longer than I think most people have expected. And things have had to, you know, programs and layoffs and furlough days, you know, there have been some pretty extreme cuts that schools have had to make that I don't think anybody was expecting were going to happen, and nobody was expecting it to get this bad. So I think it's just more just uncertainty about how bad is it going to get, and what else are schools going to have to cut back to survive if this keeps going on for another 6 months, another year, who knows? So none of the schools necessarily have said that they wouldn't honor scholarship money, but, you know, in a lot of cases, the perception might be stronger than the reality.
And if it's not that,
that's just the anxiety of it.
And if it's not that, maybe it's something else that you would benefit from if the school is able to afford it. But now there are fewer tutoring hours, or quality of life issues suffer. And at the end of the article, you guys talk about, and this is kind of a pet peeve, I think, for a lot of us, how mm-hmm. tuition is going up. And one of the reasons is because mm-hmm. there's less funding at the state level anymore.
Right. And that's the trend that's been going on for the last 15 years, that the weight towards tuition dollars has really shifted quite a bit more. And as you said, tuition is going up, up and up. So, yeah, I mean, that is definitely when you have the tuition dollars as high as they are, you know, parents and students fairly want to make sure that they're getting the bank, you know, everything that they pay for. And if $40,000 in tuition, $50,000, however much it is, can't buy you that assurance that your kid is going to have the very best educational opportunities, the very best quality of life at that school, then, you know, what's the point? That's what, you know, we heard a lot of people say.
Well, and I didn't realize, I mean, how reliant the schools are on tuition. I mean,
right.
I believe you said, depending on the school, one of them anyway, 75% of the funding for the school came from tuition, and now it's less than 50%. Or no, that was the state.
Exactly.
And the point is that now the parents and the kids are having to borrow or save more to pay for it. And that's, I think, frankly, we've already outpriced education for families. The idea that, you know, they're going to have to pay even more, I just don't think is a workable solution.
Well, and a lot of schools, at least in the fall, a lot of schools have really worked hard to either keep their tuition rate flat into next year or even have dropped it into next year. And that's a big selling point. But still, you know, you're right. This is, you know, after years and years of rising tuition. So, you know, the cost to families is huge, and it's a major investment for them, even more so than, you know, it, in terms of dollars, even more so than it would have been, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. But yeah, I mean, definitely the reliance on tuition is enormous. So if kids are kids and families are really second guessing a decision to go to a particular school, that's really eating into an even greater source of funding for these schools than lost state appropriations.
Well, not to get all Bernie Sanders on you, but, you know, there's this this debate about how much should all of us, the taxpayers, the state, the federal government, how much should we fund college education? And some people think Bernie's crazy and we can't afford it, and maybe he is and maybe we can't, but we're already doing it anyway. We are subsidizing, at least the state level, tuition for kids and their families. You might not go to a college, but you're helping the kid down the street do so with your tax dollars. And I'm an advocate of that. I think the 12th grade is sort of the cutoff for a free public education is artificial, and that if the times have changed, so too should that. I don't know where the Republicans are all on this, but I know where Bernie and Hillary differ. She thinks lower rates are the way to go, and Bernie thinks we actually ought to just continue to fund education for people. And people say, oh, that's crazy. We can't do that. Well, we already are. It's just how much are we willing to spend on that? And right now, the pendulum is swinging, in this guy's opinion, in the wrong direction. And the families have to pick up the difference.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this might be somewhat tangential, but I mean, if you look at how much, you know, average families have to borrow in order to pay for, you know, in order to pay for higher education, I mean, it's really a massive amount. And then you have lower income students who are, you know, relying in part on grants and, you know, other state assistance. And that's a huge part of this story as well, about, you know, students who really rely on, you know, state dollars to help them pay for their education, and they're not getting that money either.
Well,
so,
and think about it.
You're already in that situation.
Well, sure, and you and I are talking about state schools. I mean, we're not even talking about Northwestern or the University of Chicago or Bradley, you know, expensive, good private schools. So if they ever there were a harbor for these kids, a safe harbor, it should be the state schools. And your headline is high schoolers and parents wary of Illinois colleges as the budget crisis hits schools. It's in tomorrow's Chicago Tribune, and you can read it online right now. Well done. Thank you, Dawn, for your time this afternoon. We'll follow up on this. All right.
I will. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Likewise. Dawn Rhodes. It's 217. So the other thing that I just wanted to mention, and maybe you have something to say about what Dawn just said, but there's something else that we were talking about a little while ago, and that is the protest in Chicago yesterday, the Friday rush hour rally, which didn't inconvenience that many people. But if you were downtown Chicago yesterday, and you were in the way of that, and by the way, I was, you know, that messes with your life. And you say, okay, well, what did I do wrong here? Why are you punishing me, goes the thinking when these sorts of things happen. If there's a rally downtown like that, and we're angry at somebody, and we're going to disrupt, and we're not just going to disrupt in a way to get us attention, we're going to actually inconvenience as many people as possible in the process. And you think, okay, but that gives us a bigger footprint in the sort of media. Sure, it does. But as someone said to me yesterday, how does that win us over to your side? you know, regardless of where you are on the Chicago teachers or public education funding and the contract they're getting and stuff like that, I think, you know, all of us, our hearts are on that side. How you manage that is the issue. But I'm kind of interested in what you think of that tactic. So what we'll do is we'll maybe close down Lakeshore Drive or Michigan Avenue or the streets over by the government center or whatever. Well, that'll be the strategy. And then if people are trying to drive through there, it'll totally screw up downtown. And so, and I don't know what the end of this thought train is. And so what? So they're going to be on our side? You can still get a lot of attention without doing that, but that's what you do. And I wonder what you think about that as a tactic. You know, because if you do something that's not too painful to people, maybe it gets ignored. I mean, I see the flip side of that. I'm just wondering what you think about it. Call me right now, John Williams on WGN. Let's start on line two with Greg. You're on WGN. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to follow up on that conversation regarding funding of higher education with state funding and stuff like that.
Sure.
I think one aspect that I think is overlooked is whether or not higher education is really needed for many of the degrees that kids are coming out of college with, say, generic business degrees or sociology degrees, where there's not jobs for a lot of these guys and gals that are getting them. And so they're going to college because they're told they need to go to college, but there's nothing at the end of the road when they get there except for a large bill. And so I think that's a little bit of something that we need to look at first and foremost before we focus on funding.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, I know students who've graduated with degrees in art history and philosopher. My electrician had a degree in philosophy, which, you know, sort of tells you something about what's waiting for some of them out there.
And even from my own personal perspective, you know, I graduated from the University of Illinois, Champaign, with a degree in economics. And, you know, I worked for a Fortune 50 company for 4.5 years out of college. So I was blessed to get a job that way. But, you know, sometimes I look and I say, did I really use anything I learned in college in that job? And I have a hard time, you know, making a connection there.
I understand that, but even you would admit you would not have gotten that job if you didn't have a degree. And it helped that you had one from U of I.
Yeah, so then the question is kind of like, so, you know, why do I have to have a degree? It's kind of like this mystery out there. You got to get a degree to get a job, but the job that you get doesn't even necessarily mean you're going to use anything from your degree. So what's the point besides spending $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 to get that degree? I mean, it gets frustrating for individuals out there who say, well, you know, I didn't really become enlightened because I went to a university to, you know, punch numbers at a keyboard in a cubicle downtown. So
that's an interesting point. And, I don't have an answer to that. I mean, I can't fix that. Although I think a lot of people are nodding their head going, yeah, why did I have to do that? I don't know why law school has to be 3 years. I'll bet you could do that in two. Right. Maybe if you're going to be a surgeon, I don't know how much schooling you're supposed to get, but I really want you to be good at that. But I think some of this stuff you learn on the job. If you can prove yourself smart enough and energetic enough, maybe a 4-year degree is kind of an artificial constraint, too. I appreciate your thought on that, Greg. Let's pick up with Michael on line one. Hi, Michael. You're on WGN.
Hello, John.
Hey, what's up?
I'm an electrician, so I'll give you my philosophic opinion.
Fair enough. What's up?
Well, I was watching PBS yesterday evening, the Week in Review.
Yeah.
And it was all about, you know, the teachers' strike for the day. And my opinion is I do not believe these teachers conducted themselves in a professional manner. With blocking of the streets, the hooting and the hollering, I believe they probably would have done better if they would have just taken the day off and just not, you know, protest in the streets like they did. You know, if they're going to make a stand, maybe they should all jump in a bus, head down to Springfield, and maybe protest down by the state capitol.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know anymore. You know, I have family and friends in Minneapolis, and I'm kind of tapped into that city there. The Black Lives Matter movement there is really volatile right now, and they have a disrupt campaign, it seems like, every week. And every week they get a lot of media attention, and every week I think people watch it, and then they go, now, and they do not feel any more aligned with the cause. And I felt the same in Chicago yesterday. I thought, I know you, this is important. We all think it's important. But is your tactic here, does this strategy actually win you support or not? And maybe they don't care. Maybe they don't care. They must not. They must know this isn't going to endear them to anybody. But that's almost beside the point for some of these things.
Well, we have a much bigger issue in the state of Illinois right now. And it's funding for basically every single thing in this state.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like the only thing we're funding right now are corrupt politicians who don't give a darn about this state.
I appreciate your phone call. I'm glad you joined us. I mean, really, some of these things I can't fix, but I'm interested in the different views you got out there. So thank you, Michael. And finally, Jim. I got a minute. Jim, you're on the air.
Well, thanks, Jeff, for taking my call. I really enjoyed your interview. But I think the a couple of premises. Number one, I'm a retired superintendent in Wisconsin, and I never condone that a strike is good for one day or whatever, because the kids are ultimately the ones who are hurt. So I don't think that's good, but I understand, too, how deflated a lot of educators feel. And now in Illinois, I think you're experiencing what is happening in Wisconsin as well, where all of a sudden there's a little attention to the funding of public education when the universities start to really get cut and hurt in budgets. And, you know, I think people, they want everybody college and career ready, yet, you know, they don't understand that for that to happen, there has to be an investment. And nobody, including me, likes to necessarily pay higher taxes. But, you know, at the same time, you've got to come to some understanding that if you want to have a better future for young people, you have to invest in education. So that was my thought.
Hey, by the way, thanks for the call. One last thing. You're gonna vote next week, aren't you?
In Wisconsin, yes. I still live here.
And Cruz is going to last I saw, he was up 10 points over Donald Trump. Is that what your guess is up there?
Well, you know what? I like to consider myself a nonpartisan, but at this point, the Republicans are getting everything they ask for, you know? And no, that's a pick-your-poison thing, and neither of them are good pro-public education.
Be interesting to see if Kasich would make a run here. I don't know that he will. It's probably too little too late. Thanks for the phone call. I'm glad you got in, Jim. It's 229. We'll get into the WGN Radio newsroom next. WGN, this is John Williams. This is our Vibe Score segment. I just realized something. Don't sweat it, Griff. I think we're going to have to do this one naked. Little technical thing just dawned on me. Normally, we fade the song, and then we bring up. Griffin is furiously typing. No, this will be magic if he can make it happen. He's trying to bring up the theme for our Vibe Score segment, that snappy little bit of music bed that we talk over when we do the Vibe Score. Vibe Score is an app that my cousin and I developed, and it's really fun here on WGN Radio. We will feed you news and stories of categories that you select. We'll keep you posted on the world around you. And then we ask you questions, and you score them on a scale of 1 to 100. That's the Vibe Score. So, for instance, Ben Affleck is in the news this week, and we asked you, we told you about why and what the story is, and then we said, okay, what's your vibe for Ben Affleck? You love him? 100. You don't? 0. Ben's Vibe Score is a 53 right now. Frankly, I think he deserves better. The movie Batman versus Superman, the Vibe Score is a 55. That's not a good number. Kristen Decker, are you there?
I am here, John.
I miss my snappy music. This is my bad. This is my bad. I don't have my snappy music with me. This is my bad.
I think that you should just play LCD Sound System the whole time because they're the best band ever.
Hold on! There's our snappy music! My muse! Now I can do this. All right. We bumped out with LCD Sound System. Griffin, why were we playing LCD Sound System? Why are they the Vibe Score music question of the day?
They played their last show at Madison Square Garden in 2011, released their last album in 2010, but they have decided, and said it was over, but they've decided to reunite. They're playing Lollapalooza this summer. They're playing a bunch of big shows, and they just started that run like a week or two ago. So
that's a new song from them?
Not a new song. No new music, but they are back on the road. And
Not yet. No new music yet. They will be coming out with new stuff probably this summer.
Yeah.
That never change, never change, never change.
Yeah.
That's a good song.
Don't make fun of my band. That's my band.
I was not loving that song. I'm sorry.
Not loving it yet. It doesn't have enough votes yet, so it's still at 88. But I feel like maybe some people will bring it down. I'm a huge fan. I love LCD Sound System.
Yeah, I gave it 100 because they deserve 100 in my book. I really do love them. I tried to win tickets to see their first show in New York. That didn't happen. I'm seeing them at Lala. They deserve 100.
Some big fans are mad that they're back together because they're kind of like, I already went through the whole emotional experience of losing this band that I cared about and maybe flew out to New York for the final show.
Final show.
But I'm happy about it because I like them, whatever. I'm glad to see them.
And I read an article where James Murphy said that he was bored. He started to create some music, and he's like, but I really want to create music with my friends, which is the band. So, yeah, I know it might look like people are mad at us for coming back, but like, I just wanted to create music with people I love, so I really respect it.
You know what they should do maybe is when bands are, I get that sort of life cycle of a band, you get together, you hit, and then you say we can't do it anymore, and then you're on the sidelines and you want to play some more. Michael Jordan came out of retirement, right? Here's what you do, though. You go ahead and use a different name, your LCE sound system or something. So you say, no, we're not LCD Sound System. We're older. We're better. In fact, we're a different band now. Batman versus Superman is one of the movies people are talking about this week. They're talking about it because the movie sucks. And so the question is, what's the Vibe Score for this? It's kind of like Rotten Tomatoes in a way, isn't it? Vibe Score, but for everything. We'll do it here for the movie Batman versus Superman. By the way, Kristen, your phone line is getting a very bad Vibe Score right now. Is that you?
Yeah. Yes. I am pulled over, but it's really windy down here. So.
All right, let's do the movies. So, 55. Griffin, you saw Batman versus Superman.
Yeah. I gave it a 25. I did not like it at all. And it's funny to hear you talk this way. Rewind a week.
Yeah.
We were in the same place at the same time. I said the same movie.
I said it was a great movie. I loved it.
And you hadn't seen it.
Hadn't seen it yet.
And you still haven't seen it.
No.
But your tune has changed anyway.
A friend of mine went to see the movie twice. He's the only adult in America who voluntarily saw the movie twice. He went and saw it. And then the next day he had his son. They're divorced. He got his son for the weekend. And he said, Dad, I really want to go see Batman and Superman. He goes, that's not a really good movie. And he said, you promised me you would take me to the movie. So he sits the kid down in the theater. And within, he said, 30 seconds, the kid goes straight to sleep. So he woke him up at the end. He said, the movie's kind of good. Is the movie good at the end anyway, Griff?
I don't know. Well, Kristen, what was your score?
I have not vibed on that yet. I was looking for it before the segment. I didn't find the category. But I would vibe it higher. I would vibe it in a 75 because I like the movie.
Yeah.
I actually like the movie a lot.
And you are seeing people on both sides, very low and very high. So then it ends up at 55, and the people are kind of torn on it, it seems like.
I think we have a new low. The category is politics, Donald Trump's statements on reproductive life, and his backtracking on that. We asked you what you thought about Donald Trump this week, and with many, many, many Vibers, the average vibe for Donald Trump this week is an all-new Vibe Score low of 3. That's almost if one person comes in with like a 98, you know, just an outlier, it would set that score differently. But everybody seems to be uniform in that he had a bad week. Maybe he'll bounce back next week. Let's do another one here. Oh, yeah, what's up, the category, which is kind of a catch-all for all sorts of things. Hamilton off the 10. We talked to Thomas Jefferson about this earlier.
Yeah.
He said if anybody should be on the 10 or any dollar bill, it would be Hamilton. But Hamilton's probably going to go off. The Treasury Secretary's probably going to announce somebody's going to come on. We asked you if you want Hamilton on or off the 10. And a 75 is a good score, right?
For leaving him on.
Yeah. This is a lot of love for Alexander Hamilton right now and keeping him on the $10 bill.
Yeah, I scored it at
I feel like it doesn't have anything to do with Alexander Hamilton or me. I just want a woman on a piece of currency. So.
Oh, yeah, right.
Bill. Put a woman on there.
Well, that's true. That was going to be slotted for some famous female, Oprah or somebody like that.
Yeah, I gave it a 45. I couldn't get super animated about it, but yeah. I do, because I think if you were going to take somebody off a piece of money, I'd say like Andrew Jackson off the 20.
If you're going to pick one.
He's the most disgraceful of right. any president. That's
yeah.
on, I mean, that's a pretty debatable category. But
he's going to stick up for him. He doesn't even have a Broadway show.
I know. So yeah, I don't exactly get why Hamilton's the one to go. It seems like he's just the next one up in, like, the redesign or whatever.
Yeah.
So I give it a 45. I'm kind of tepid, but I'd say take him off. Get somebody. Just mix it up a little bit.
One more. Chicago is the category. We feed you stories and topics about Chicago and ask you to vibe on them. We asked you about the teachers' union shutting down traffic in Chicago yesterday, and that's getting an 18. I just think that's sad because I scored it a little higher than that. But we asked you not about their cause, but about the tactic, and that got a very low score, an 18 on a scale of 1 to 100. And if you said, what do you think?
Very low.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you and I were downtown.
Need to go to detention for that because that's ridiculous to shut down traffic.
Vibe score is one word, V-I-B-E-S-C-O-R-E. You can get the app at the App Store. All right, Kristen Decker, thanks for chiming in as you always do.
All right.
See you later.
Thank you.
There she goes. Bye. That's our friend Kristen Decker. And that's our Vibe Score segment. It's 2:46 on WGN. Like me on Facebook. I'm John Williams. On Facebook, I'm King John there. I want to be king someday. But I talked to President Thomas Jefferson now and again. And the podcast that we just dropped this week, we post, among other places, on my Facebook page. So I'd like you to find it there. Anyway, I was talking to him the other day. And it's weird to say I was talking to Thomas Jefferson the other day. But anyway, he said, you know, with this system you have of electing a president with the caucuses and the primaries and the party process, there's another way to think about that. And this is part of the podcast. Here's him imagining another way we could elect a president.
What if you had a series of candidates who maybe 20 or 25, and they were whittled down through this process to 7 or 10, so that each one of them was regarded as someone worthy to be the president of the United States. And at that point, you threw dice or brought in some random element. You see what this would do? It would make it less likely for any single individual ever to be able to count on being president, and it would eliminate the money factor. But the idea that one person and one person only is worthy to be the president of the United States is nonsense. In a society of 6 million in my time, I could think of 20 or 30 people who could as well have been president in 1800 as I was. And in your era, when you have 330 million people, that is a third of a billion people, it's impossible not to conceive that there are hundreds, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of right. people who could equally well perform as the president. And yet, for all of that, for a third of a billion people, you're nominating in one party someone whose behavior is so erratic that even people who admire him cringe at some of the things that come out of his mouth.
Well, think of what that would do to campaign financing. It would be kind of irrelevant then, wouldn't it? Because
solves that problem, doesn't it?
There's no point in spending all that money because it's going to be the roll of the dice. So there's, in this case, it would have been Trump, Cruz, Rubio, Kasich, Carson, and Jeb Bush. Maybe on a national stage there on CNN or Fox, they'd throw the dice. And the idea is that any one of them is as good as another.
It's a Greek principle. The reason I'm quoting it, it really comes from ancient Athens. They had a system called ostracism. I don't know if you know much about that, but every year the electors, the white males, the non-slave males of Athens, would gather in the agora, in the forum, and they would take little pieces of pottery, and they would write on that pottery the person they most wanted to banish. And so let's say it was John Williams. Let's say that out of the 26,000 people, you got the majority. Then they would come to you and say, John, we mean no disrespect, but we're banishing you for 10 years.
Wow.
So you could do this with this Trump. You could say, look, you've raised some very interesting questions. You've stirred some passions. You obviously have tapped into some important concerns and frustrations that the American people have. But we choose to banish you because we think you're dangerous. So thanks for what you've done. We hope you make a lot of money in Europe or wherever you happen to go. And in 10 years from now, if you still have this ambition, you'll probably be more mellow and you will have thought about this in absentia and you can try again.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I was reading a book the other day about other voting and election systems, and it seems so obvious. Well, everybody votes and whoever gets the most votes wins. But what can happen is you'll have somebody could win with 35% of the vote. You know, somebody else gets 34 and somebody else gets 33. And what that means is Mr. 35% wins, but you also have just now elected somebody that 65% of the people passed on. And a reverse system is interesting where you say, okay, say just of the Republican candidates or the Democrats for that matter, but there's more of them to think about. From our podcast that you can find with Thomas Jefferson, you can subscribe to it. You can also just check it out on my Facebook page. I'm King John there, but interesting idea, eh? Let's visit with the boys from The Beat now. Adam Hoge and Mark Carmen are getting ready to talk sports with you. And then we've got NC2A hoops coming up later today, right, guys?
We do, John.
How about that?
Final Four. It's a little bit different feeling for me this year. You know, last year my Wisconsin Badgers were gearing up for a huge game against undefeated Kentucky, and they pulled off one of the most ridiculously awesome wins of all time. My dad and I were there in Indianapolis. So today it's just, it's kind of a... I don't know.
Do you see that, John? It's just all about Adam Hoge.
It's about the Badgers.
It's all about Adam and his family. And, this is just – I find that offensive, John, don't you?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I think, boy, this is what an ass this guy is. I can't take any more of it. Although, I hate to say this, Mark, but a friend of mine is a Wisconsin guy. Oh. And I don't remember the statistic, but he was telling me how – over the last 16 or 20 years, Wisconsin's team has been one of the most prevalent teams in the NCAA tournament or something like that.
I think I can give it to you, Jeff.
Yeah, what is that number?
Back to 2002, 2003, that school year, the Wisconsin is the only school in the entire country that has had their football team go to a bowl game and their basketball team go to the NCAA tournament.
That's pretty good. That's a lot of fun for you guys, isn't it?
It is. I just would like one national title, that's probably sounding very greedy. But when you have a 9-point lead with 8 minutes to go in the national championship game against Duke and you blow that, it stings a little bit for still obviously a year later.
I can add on just a couple for the Badger fans out there, John, and your friend. 11 wins in the NCAA tournament the last 3 years, most in all of college basketball. That would be the Wisconsin Badgers. The only team that's been in the Sweet 16 the last 3 years, the Wisconsin Badgers. A lot of pride out of Madison. I know that, yes, very disappointing performance in the championship game when you're up and you think you're going to win, and you'll never get over that for the rest of your life. but it's been a great three years.
Try and say that, Carmen, like you care, okay? Yeah. Like that didn't come across.
Well, I mean, in cup terms, you're never going to get over 84.
That's true.
You're never going to get over 2003, and who knows what's coming down the pipe.
You see what I successfully did here, John. I just made the Final Four all about the Wisconsin Badgers.
Even though they're not even there.
Exactly.
By the way, did I see your picture in a glossy magazine downstairs today?
Mine?
Yeah. Adam, were you at some fancy wine thing and you were wearing a tie and then you look in these society pages and it has the little names of the people? And I've always wondered, who are those beautiful people drinking wine in these things? There's a magazine downstairs in the tea shop, that Argo Tea or whatever it is?
Yeah.
It's a CS magazine. Have you seen that thing? And I'm strumming through there, and there is a picture of you there.
I'll have to check it out.
You don't know about this.
I don't, and I'm not much of a wine drinker.
I'm not sure that was wine in your hand, to be honest with you, but everybody else was doing something like that.
If it was scotch, it would make sense.
It would make more sense, huh?
John, I was once in Chicago Magazine. It was 1998. There was a picture of Michael Jordan at his locker, and in the deep, deep, deep corner, you could see my arm extending towards Jordan.
Do you have that picture? Is that like you had that blown up? Is that in your room or something like that?
I've got like 7 copies of the magazine, and yes, a huge blow up photo on my wall. And I just stare at it every morning when I wake up and say, "Wow, aren't I cool?"
Give me one more second to tell this story. I'm looking at my producer Griffin because he was in this picture, and I'm trying to remember the game. What was the game? It was the Aesop Choi game, the collision game, or what am I thinking of?
Yeah, I was at that game.
Okay, what game am I talking about, guys? About what year?
You're talking 2003. That was
Cubs-Yankees.
Cubs-Yankees at Wrigley. Eric Karros hit a three-run homer, I want to say, off of Roger Clemens. Cubs
it was
won 3-0.
So awesome to see Cubs-Yankees. Beautiful day.
Maybe
3-1. Hardest ticket to get in years. And we had like four or five tickets. But then what was the collision that took place between first and second base? Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was Aesop Choi trying to catch one of those short, high pop-ups. And he ran into...
I think he ran into Kerry Wood.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that sounds right. Okay.
And that was the end of his career, basically.
So at that pivotal moment in Cubs history, I'm there at the game with my family. And my young son says, hey, I have to go to the bathroom. And so we go to the bathroom. And then we're walking back, and we hear this roar. And at that moment, a Sports Illustrated photographer took a picture from sort of inside the concourse out. So you're able to see that. And if the picture doesn't exactly match my description of it, I'm going to tell you what it feels like. And what you'll see is what's most important to me here. So you see the field, and then you see some fans walking on the concourse. And you're like, who are those dopes that are walking on the concourse inside? They're missing what's going on outside. And we look closer and go, oh, my God, that's me and my son. They've got a picture of us in Sports Illustrated at that game walking along the concourse coming back from the bathroom.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, except it's us not watching the game. It's us going to the bathroom at like this great big moment. So it's kind of bittersweet, I'll say.
Yes, but, you know, nature calls, John. It's okay.
You guys are going to have a good show, and then we've got basketball. The pregame starts at 4 o'clock, right?
That's correct. We'll talk a little bit of basketball. We also got to get this Duncan Keith suspension stuff.
Man, how about that? Are you guys satisfied with that?
Lucky day for the Blackhawks.
Yeah, I think it's a lucky day for the Blackhawks.
Could have been worse. Okay, have a good show, fellas,
thanks,
and we'll be listening. We'll get you into the newsroom next on WGN.